Before we get started, I would like to introduce our moderator for the panel. I'm very pleased to introduce Sama Elibiari. She has been a longtime activist for human rights, and she likes to call herself radioactive. Sounds dangerous.
It is, in fact, yes. Media is important.
Yes, and she has just arrived back in Montreal from Egypt, so we are very, very happy to have her with us this afternoon. She presents a unique perspective on current events, from politics to religion to culture, pertaining to Arabs and Muslims at home and abroad through her radio program, Caravan. Caravan is broadcast on CKUT 90.3 FM, and it has been running uninterruptedly every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. since it started in 1997. So that's wonderful. So without further ado, I'll let Sama take it over. Thank you.
Thank you, Erin. Hello, everybody. Assalamu alaikum. It is my pleasure to be the moderator of today's panel.
Why is it important to talk about Islamophobia? Because it affects seriously and profoundly the life of an entire community. Because it is used to justify far-reaching political decisions. Think about the role of Canada in Afghanistan. Because it negates the moral values of our society that we want to be just and inclusive. And last but not least, because it negatively influences our thoughts and feelings towards a major faith group. But what do we mean exactly when we talk about Islamophobia? My answer, I know it when I see it. But rest assured, our panelists will explain this fully. Now, talking about the role of the media when dealing with Islam and Muslims, allow me to ask the following questions. When was the last time you've read or seen something positive about Islam or Muslims? When and where did you ever read or see progress made by Muslim women, locally or internationally, being reported? When did you see any recognizable Muslim character, men or women, playing a positive role on any TV program? When did you see a hijabi woman speaking in the media about something different than why she covers her head? When did you ever read a serious explanation about the scary word, Sharia? If you answer, don't remember, to any one of the above questions, I think you will find what our panelists have to say very informative. Our first panelist will be Samir Zuberi. He speaks about Islamophobia in Canadian media, presence, acceptance, and impact. Samir Zuberi is the former vice president of the Concordia Student Union and former communication and human rights coordinator at the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE. CARE is Canada's leading Muslim advocacy organization. Today, Samir sits on the board of the Canadian Muslim Forum and is a member of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. He is also a UQAM law student and a legal researcher. And not mentioned in his bio, but we're very proud to say, Samir is also the father of a lovely young daughter, Rayan. Please join me to welcome Samir Zuberi.
I want to first off thank the PGSS for hosting this, CKUT for reporting on it. This is a very important issue, and this is where we can discuss these issues. Organizations like the PGSS and CKUT create space so that sensitive, hot topics that are not discussed in the mainstream can be brought forth so that we hope in the future they can be adopted by the mainstream. I was asked to speak today on the issue of Islamophobia in the media, and that's a very broad issue, a very new issue. I have dealt with this in the past on some level, both in academics, but also in the public, having addressed also parliamentarians and students on the issue of Islamophobia. As Sama said, Islamophobia is an important issue to first define, and it's one that is not... well recognized at this point. In fact, the term Islamophobia is a very hard term for people to digest. people are used to the term discrimination towards Muslims. They're used to xenophobia. They're used to anti-Semitism, but they're not yet used to the term Islamophobia. According to Kofi Annan, he mentioned this in the United Nations. He said that the term Islamophobia actually really emerged in the 1980s or late 90s. In the French, however, though, it's been used as of the 1900s until today, Islamophobia. But when it comes to the English language, Islamophobia is a very new term, one that we aren't yet used to. It's still a very strong term. But why are we talking about this today, and why is Islamophobia becoming a hot topic, so to speak? Well, actually, there was a very important report done in 1997 which popularized Islamophobia. This was done by a UK body called the Runnymede Trust. The Runnymede Trust in 1997 went around the UK, meeting with Muslim communities, meeting with public intellectuals, professors, students, etc., and came up with a report called Islamophobia, A Challenge for Us All. And in that report, what was so groundbreaking about their report was that they came up with a series of open and closed values or ideas that people had towards Islam and Muslims. And to just give you an idea of what would be, under Runnymede's definition, Islamophobic versus an open idea, an Islamophobic idea or a discriminatory idea would be that Muslims are monolithic, one big body. There are no shades of gray in between. They're just one body. Versus the open view that Muslims are diverse. There are many shades of gray in between. There is black, there is white, and there's many others in between. A second idea is that Muslims are separate from society. This is a view that, in Runnymede's opinion, was discriminatory. Whereas an open view is that Muslims are interacting, that they seek to interact with society. And if you speak with Muslims, that's what you will find. Yes, they might be distinct in some ways. Some Muslims might appear distinct in some ways. However, Muslims still do seek to interact and contribute and become part of society. Third point Runnymede defined is that Muslims are an enemy versus a partner that can be worked with. This is an open and closed view. So they had many open and closed views, but what was very important with Runnymede was that they helped define the terrain. And because of that, then the term Islamophobia became popularized, became adopted, and that's why we're sitting here today. Most importantly, though, I think with this report at that time in 1997, was that the findings of the Runnymede report were presented by a then Minister of Government, Jack Straw, who presented it to the population, the UK population, and the world, these findings that I just mentioned. In Canada, though, we haven't seen anything close to the investigation and the reporting done by Runnymede. What we have seen has not been at the level of government. It has been at the level of students, though. So there's a lot of hope when it comes to students. The CFS in 2007 held many town halls across Ontario. They visited 17 to 19 university campuses and interviewed groups of students like this one. And they asked people about a number of different topics relating to accommodation on campus, relating to the image and portrayal of Muslims in the classroom, relating to the media, and they came up with a report, a 100-odd page report. This report you can find online. And they also said that discrimination is an issue on campus. They said that discrimination is an issue in the media and one that must be addressed. Now we defined Islamophobia, we looked at it, to segue now into the media itself, which is why we're really all here. Now, we all read the papers, we all listen to the radio, we watch television, we see what's going on in the world. And what do we see? We see the media giving us information. Now, an interesting question to ask is the media inherently Islamophobic? That's an important question to ask. Personally, I would argue no. The media is not inherently Islamophobic. What the media is, it has a certain DNA, is that the media works on clash. Number one, there must be conflict in order for the media to run a story. Otherwise, you will not have a story. Nobody wants to hear about the 10 old ladies who cross the road safely. They want to hear about that one kid, that four-year-old kid, who was buried under the snow and saved. That's sensationalism. In terms of conflict, they want to hear about bombs, explosions, what's happening in Libya, what's happening in Egypt, what's happening in Yemen. You know, they want to hear about these things, the domestic terrorism cases. These are really interesting to people. This is conflict. This is what sells newspapers, what gets viewers in front of the television. With respect to the second issue that is part of the DNA of the media after conflict is sensationalism. The media needs sensational stories. So as Sama said, have you ever seen a woman in hijab talk about anything else but her hijab? Not often. It doesn't usually happen. Have you ever seen a visible Muslim talk about something else other than their identity? It doesn't oftentimes happen. You don't see engineers on television who look visibly Muslim. You don't see sociologists on television who look visibly Muslim. You don't see these people on TV. This has yet to be done. Now, with the DNA aside, and this is part of the reason why Islamophobia is coming to the fore in the media, with conflict and sensationalism aside, which is part of the DNA of the media, we also have a third element which contributes to the misunderstanding of minority communities, Muslims being one of them. And the misunderstanding that is oftentimes brought forth is actually in the newsroom, when journalists sit around the table and decide on a story, what to report and how to report it. Who is around the table? You'll not find people from diverse communities oftentimes. Or if you do, they're at very junior levels. They're not at senior positions. So the organizational talking points or the organizational directives are not coming from minorities and Muslims, or Muslims, I should say, but they're coming from people who either don't know Muslims or have potentially a misunderstanding on who Muslims are. As a result of that, the journalists around the table are, for better or worse, shaping stories that do not accurately portray who Muslims are. This is a third major reason why we see misrepresentations of Muslims being brought forth in the press, on TV, in the radio, etc. Now, what does this really lead to? The effects are serious in terms of society. The effects of Islamophobia, they're real, and they impact people's lives directly. Those who are visibly Muslim are every day impacted by discrimination as a result of the media's portrayal of them. They will receive comments on the street. They will not get hired for jobs. This is a regular occurrence, and sometimes it's overt, direct. Speak with women in this room, and you will find that the comments that they receive, probably on a weekly basis, are bigoted and hurtful. This impacts them. This has a serious impact on them. With respect to people who are visibly Muslim, they might not get hired for a job. It might not be said, we're not going to hire you because of who you are, but it's something unspoken. So the impacts are real on a population, on a people who look a certain way. And you don't even have to be Muslim, actually. Sikhs are attacked for wearing the turban because they're mistaken as being, I don't know what, maybe an Arab or something, right? So they're attacked on the street too. You don't have to be Muslim to receive the bigoted comments. You could simply be a colored man, an Indian man, shaved, clean shaven, working as an engineer. People will label on that caricature on you. So it impacts people directly, visible minorities. Second, it also creates a rupture in social cohesion. And we all saw that in Quebec in the reasonable accommodation debates between 2005 to 2007. There was a real attack on minorities, even Anglophones, but in particular, most Muslims were attacked. And we saw that all the time. There was the sugar shack issue. There was a taekwondo issue, the girl who was playing taekwondo. There was a soccer issue. There were so many of them. In fact, Bouchard and Taylor did an analysis on this, and I don't agree with their report entirely. There are a lot of recommendations I'm strongly against, but the report is important because it studies the issue and it puts research forth. And it's a reference point in some ways. And what they said was that they looked at the media reporting on Muslims, and they said the vast majority of reports during the reasonable accommodation debate on Muslims were misrepresentations, that they were twisted, that the full story wasn't given to the population. And as a result, people in Quebec came out with a story that was very different from what the actual story was. That's a very important finding that created a rupture in the social cohesion of Quebec, of this province, and of this country. The Bouchard-Taylor report also said that the media should have restrained themselves during this debate. And in fact, media representatives agreed with that statement on Bouchard and Taylor. They agreed that the media betrayed its principles of fair representation. The impacts of Islamophobia as a result of the media's misportrayal of Muslims oftentimes has real and serious impacts. It has created lack of understanding, and also, in addition to that, it creates a loss of real potential. Why? Because we spoke about the issue of discrimination. That means that qualified people who can do a job competently are not getting hired for that job as a result of discrimination. Therefore, society's potential as a whole is diminished. Not simply the potential of individuals, but the potential of society as a whole. There's a loss, there's a net loss in this province, in this country, as a result of discrimination. Now, to conclude, I think there are signs of hope. There really are. Now, why do I say that? Not to be cliche, but for one, I think personally Obama is a sign of hope, as opposed to Bush. You see, Bush, his rhetoric, what was it? It was terrorist. It was, some even looked at it and picked up a crusade here and there, right? His rhetoric was extremely confrontational, Bush's. And it created an us versus them sort of scenario in America, but also went across the world. Now, you look at Obama, he's been very careful in his speech about Muslims. I'm not going to give him a carte blanche, you know, he's done a lot of errors. But just if you look at in terms of the discourse, what is happening? His discourse is much more positive than his predecessor. So that's a sign of hope, in order to not be, too cliche or whatever. A second sign of hope, I would say, is that if you look at first off, there's CKUT, which deals with the issues directly, head on, and doesn't mince words. There's organizations like the PGSS, which bring forth this sort of conversation. And this has impacted, I would say, the mainstream. If you look at the CBC, for example, just within this past month, they held a town hall on bias and belonging. And they had four Muslims come forth and speak about the issues of bias and belonging. And although Islamophobia wasn't directly discussed there by the panelists, it was touched upon by them, it wasn't the main theme, it was something that was addressed within the audience. The audience brought forth their personal experiences with Islamophobia as a result of media's misrepresentation. And finally, I think all of us in this room are a sign of hope. Why? Because we're gathering on an important issue. On this issue, we're trying to learn and understand this issue better. And how can we act so that we will make the situation better? We got to take what's happening in this room and really bring it beyond these four walls. And I would say tomorrow, first off, please do attend the conference. And although it's not on the issue of Islamophobia directly, it is quite important that we become skilled in this issue of equity in the media. I think also it's important for us to learn about who Muslims are. Studies show that Islamophobia and discrimination towards Muslims are reduced when you get to know who your neighbor is. And Montreal is a great place to see who Muslims are, because you go to school with them, you work with them. And for those of you who are Muslims, you know, reach out and get to speak with people that you work with in your classrooms and at work. When you hear something on the radio, you know, give a call in to the radio show. They always leave their number afterwards and they say, you can call in and voice your opinion on what you heard. If you feel that something is discriminatory, or if you agree with what they said, tell them, I agree with what that individual said. This was a good thing that they did. Or if on the flip side, if you don't agree, voice your opinion and write into the papers. Even if your letter doesn't get published, it will get read by the editor and will impact the editor's opinion, which is a decision maker who is a gatekeeper to allow a voices and opinion forth. So even if your letter is not published, go ahead. And for all of those of you who are students, You know, do research on this issue. Speak about it in your classes. Talk about it with your peers. And on that note, which I hope that everybody will act in some way, I'll leave it here and pass it to my colleague, who's also named Samir.
Thank you very much, Samir Zaveri. I'd like to mention that the word Islamophobia was introduced here by the Bouchard-Taylor's Commission, and indeed the Bouchard-Taylor Commission did speak about the role of the media, the negative role of the media. Unfortunately, not much has been done on this issue in particular. Samir also mentioned the impact on Muslims, and let me share with you the story. I was coming yesterday from Cairo through Paris, and at the Paris airport, most of those who were in front of me and even behind me passed the line, and they stopped me, and they decided to search my carry-on luggage. And sure enough, they got out a small box, and what was, I said, it's cheese, so open it. I opened it. No, the cheese was not hard. It was paste, pâte, c'est une pâte, and this is not allowed because the cheese was wobbling a little bit. It was not firm. And so they said, you can't pass with this box of cheese. You either have to eat it on the spot or we have to... And it was 400 grams. They read the label, 400 grams. You're only allowed 100 grams. I said, okay, I'll throw away 300 and I'll keep 100. My sister had given me the cheese and I really wanted it. So they said, no, the container is big. It should be a small container for 100 grams. I don't know if it had been another person, would they have been so stringent about it, but just the same, it is my experience whenever I go through the airports, I'm always the person to go through the random search, you know, it's very random. All right, so we'll have the opportunity to ask questions to Samir and also our other Samir Hussein after the panel. Samir Hussein is a social justice organizer, and he's going to be talking about social justice organizing and Islamophobia in the age of the war on terror. Samir has been part of an anti-authoritarian social justice movement in Montreal for almost a decade. Over the years, he has been involved in Indigenous solidarity activists, migrant justice work, as well as organizing against police violence and national security state agendas. He is also involved with the health justice initiatives. Currently, Samir is active with the Justice for the NS Coalition and Project Fly Home. He is part of the No One Is Illegal campaign, and may I add that you may recall that Muhammad Anas Benis, a young Muslim man, was shot by the police as he was leaving a mosque in NDG after the early morning prayers. To this day, many questions remain unanswered, and thanks to concerted efforts of his support group, the group Justice for Anas, the case is going to be re-examined. About the Project Fly Home, this concerned another case involving a Muslim man of Sudanese origin, Abdurrazak Abu Sufyan. And without the tireless campaign of this project, Abu Sufyan would still be in a Sudanese jail, although no charge has been ever filed against him. Well, please join me to welcome Samir.
So I'd like to thank Sama, and thank the organizers for having invited me to speak. There's a lot of familiar faces in the audience and some elders too, so it's great to see people, and there's a lot of people I don't recognize, which is also excellent. So I was specifically asked to talk about resistance to Islamophobia, which is a huge topic. That is very difficult to do justice to that in 20 minutes, but we'll try to do what we can. Basically, I'm going to try to cover a few things in the 20 minutes or so that I have. Initially, I just want to, before even broaching the topic of Islamophobia, I think it's important to set out some basic understanding, a basic framework of where I'm personally coming from and where a lot of the movements I'm involved with are also coming from. I want to focus on McGill as well, with respect to Islamophobia historically, at least in the last 10 years and up until quite recently, with McGill being in the headlines actually around issues of national security and quote-unquote terrorism this past summer. I'll also want to touch on points around the security certificate regime and the 1267 regime, which is the regime that basically has imprisoned Abu Sufyan Abdul Razik that Sama was referring to. And I want to specifically look at the reasonable accommodations debate, but not the debate in and of itself that Samir talked about, but specifically organizing against it to confront the racist, xenophobic, and sexist discourse that that came up around that time. And for me personally, I mean, it's already been mentioned what my involvements are, and I would still like to just clarify in terms of the organizing against reasonable accommodations, as well as security certificate regime, we often come from the same movements, but the incredible work that was done was not necessarily done. I wasn't that active in those two movements, so I don't want to take credit for the immense work that people did on both of those issues. So as a backgrounder, I think before talking about Islamophobia in general, I want to broaden the discussion a bit more and touch quickly on questions of historical and geopolitical realities, because I think I don't want to go too much in depth, but I think it's important to root any kind of discussion on about Islamophobia in history and in geopolitical realities. And basically, in a nutshell, what that means is that there's large-scale forces of oppression that produce misery, produce poverty, produce migration, produce displacement. And that happens here, that happens in the Global South. There's very few spaces that are free of that. And that's there to essentially perpetuate a system, a capitalist system that benefits the rich and exploits the poor. That's fundamentally what it comes down to. And when we're talking about Islamophobia, you know, in that process, what basically ends up happening is that there's Muslims, Arabs, South Asians, as Samir also mentioned, that are basically created as an enemy class. But there's reflections of that creation of an enemy class that come from foreign policy, right? It's not a coincidence that Islamophobia happens domestically in various ways while the United States and Canada and European countries are leading a war, which is an invasion and an occupation of Afghanistan, for example. But I think at the same time, what's also important is to recognize that Muslims are not alone in being created as an enemy class. And there's been historically and continue to be communities that are attacked, black community, indigenous communities here, queer people, feminists, trans folk, street people, anarchists, communists, basically any person or group that challenge in some form or another the oppressive social and political structures that characterize our lives and those that it benefits. To name them, I mean, these are sort of ideologies with big names, but they do have names, and they're patriarchy and white supremacy and capitalism and colonialism and imperialism and heteronormativity. And these are all ideologies. When we say the name, it may not mean very much, but they have very, very significant tangible impacts on the everyday lives of people across the world and people here locally. And I think that is what's also important, is to recognize the effect that foreign policy has on domestic policy and vice versa. And that interchange plays a significant role in how Islamophobia also expresses itself. The current context here also obviously involves the Harper government, and that's really important that to recognize that since the Harper government's been in power in 2006, there's been enormous attacks on women's movements, on indigenous communities, on the poor, on the working class, as well as on Muslim, Arab, South Asian communities, but also on social movements. And I think that's always really important to highlight, because I don't know if people here were in Toronto when the G20 happened, but we saw clearly at that point in time what the fascist tendencies of Canada and what they are, with people being stopped every corner by police for no reason. And at that moment, it was actually a time where it became a short period of time, but it was still a time where activists were not the only ones that are being targeted. It was people walking down the street who happened to be taking the bus, and they felt for a short period of time, and it's completely not justified, but for that short period of time, they felt what it was like to be Indigenous and living in inner cities, or to be Muslim and be profiled because of how someone looks or how someone dresses. And I think that in and of itself is important to keep in mind as we continue to try to develop resistance against these forms of oppression. So the McGill focus, to talk a bit quickly on McGill, in terms of Islamophobia, I guess it's perhaps easier to go back to about 10 years now, September 11, 2011, and see what happened here. I mean, it's completely anecdotal, but I remember around that time, two incidents struck me. One was, I actually was at McGill at the time, and a friend, a classmate and friend of mine who's from Iran had his car vandalized the day after 9/11. But what was interesting was the vandals wrote, "Arab, go home." Which I guess just exhibits their own ignorance, but because my friend was Persian, but it was very shocking for my friend. Obviously, he considered leaving the city. The other case that I remember coming up that was quite striking was a woman who, if I'm not mistaken, was a resident actually at a hospital who wore a hijab, and she was attacked in an elevator. And I mean, those are two anecdotes, but they happened, McGill or McGill campus, that are quite significant. And there's a reason why I'm focusing on McGill, and that is, I'm going to show a video, and I'm going to let you guys see if this is familiar to you.
Canadian Idol, it's Karan.
How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So you hail from Pakistan, eh?
Yes, I came.
How long have you been here?
I've been here for a couple of years. I came in 2K5, so it's been about 3 years now.
Okay, so what song are you going to sing for us?
I can sing like different things, like Hilary Duff or April Lavigne. Or...
Okay, so what are you going to sing first?
Do whatever you
want.
Well,
let's take a vote, whatever you guys.
Complicated.
Complicated.
Sing a song.
Okay, so two words to one. We'll count you as abstaining. Complicated it is.
I like you the way you are. When we're driving in your car and you're talking to me one on one, will you become somebody else around everyone else? You're watching your back like you can't relax. You try to be cool, you look like a fool to me. Tell me why you have to go and make things so complicated. I see the way you're acting like you're somebody else that gets me frustrated. Life's like this and you.
But I have a feeling the judge's decision won't be all that complicated.
Turn it into honesty and promise me I'm never gonna find you fake it. No, no, no.
Have you ever thought of being a comedian or...
Not really. I like hockey, music, acting.
The dance moves were good, the singing bad. I'm a no. Good dance moves. Now Jake would know.
Sorry.
Well, that was some genuine crap singing.
Ben is not here. I want to give him the hat and call him Ivan Mulroney. But anyways, thank you.
So how many people have seen this before? And do people know who, aside for the YouTube, do people know who Khurram is? Can people lift a hand in terms of, yeah. So, a few people. I mean, basically, Khurram Sher was on August 26th of 2010, arrested for quote-unquote terrorism-related charges, conspiracy to commit terror act. He went to medical school here. He did his residency here in the Department of Pathology. I mean, this is obviously a joke, right? Like, this is I mean, he's putting this on. He was born and raised in Montreal. So this is sort of a joke that I guess he was doing to sort of make a mockery of people who make mockery of Muslims. But his name and this appearance actually made national and international headlines because of the fact that on August 26th, he was arrested with two other people from based in Ottawa at the time on these terror-related charges, and that basically brought McGill to in the headlines at the time. And I think it's important to look at that and to look at the media response around that time. I don't know if people had a chance to look at the kinds of media coverage that was done, but it was phenomenal in terms of the xenophobia and the racism and the stereotyping that went completely unchecked. There's a friend and a longtime activist, Matthew Behrens, who's involved with a campaign to stop secret trials, and he actually wrote a sort of a critique looking at the media articles that were that came out in a week or two following the arrests. I'm not going to read his whole critique, but it's worth actually looking up on the internet. If you just Google Attack of the Beards and with Matthew Behrens as a name, I'm sure it'll come up. But some of the points that he drew out from the media review that he did were articles talking about these men sporting a bushy beard and a knitted skull cap. References continuously to full long beards, to the fact that their wife or wives wore niqab, depending on if they were referring to one or more people. There was a quote by in the Ottawa Citizen of one of the accused taking an extended vacation more than a year ago and having returned home with a grown full beard. It wasn't known where he spent the weeks he was away, right? Like, people have to tell people where you go on vacation, because if you don't, you come back wearing a beard, it's like some kind of revelation that happened while you were there and you become a quote-unquote extremist. Another article talked about the wife of one of the men dressing modestly. I don't know what the hell that means. But obviously there was some kind of connotation with that. Again, full beard often worn by Muslim men of strong faith. Another one commented on a full but neatly trimmed beard. So that potentially sort of mitigates the extent of like the person's, you know, extremist views, I guess. And that's what Matthew basically says. Can you tell a good Muslim from a bad Muslim by the length and the curliness of their facial hair? Right? Because that's ultimately what basically was being done, like quite literally, actually, in terms of the articles that were coming out. Then another Star, a Toronto Star article, reported a neighbor of one of the accused men saying that the first time she saw him, after having moved into her neighborhood, he was pacing his lawn with his hands behind his back. That's pretty scary stuff. I can just go on and on. It's worthwhile to look at this, but given the fact that, you know, the topic today is the media, I think it's particularly insightful to look at how these kinds of comments and assertions are made completely unchecked. Like, there's no editorial policy, it seems, to say what's the relevance of bringing up these kinds of points. But then it can get a lot more nefarious and pernicious beyond that. I mean, that's bad enough, but journalists that basically cite newspapers from Pakistan, specifically the Daily Times of Pakistan, where in that it's alleged that they had some kind of investigation that they did that links the three arrested in Ottawa, well, two arrested in Ottawa and one in London, Ontario, Khurram, with the Pakistani Taliban, but it's all like these assertions that are completely unjustified, and it's getting degrees and degrees of separation, and it just gets passed off as being the truth, right? So basically, ultimately, what ends up happening is that in these kinds of situations, the people who are accused are basically standing trial publicly before they actually stand trial legally. Because up until now, none of the charges have been, the trial actually hasn't even started yet. They've, two of the three have been released on bail, but aside from that, there's not been anything more significant than that. With regards to Khurram specifically, and that's why I played this, because I sort of hesitated of playing the clip because I had seen it before Khurram was arrested, but afterwards it was sort of difficult for people who knew him either through medical school or whatever at McGill to watch that because of the fact that he spent time in prison and given the charges that he's facing. And Matthew, in his article, mentions this August 27th headline in the Ottawa Citizen that basically says, "Your friends and neighbors, the face of homegrown terror." And that's basically what the arrest, the Project Samosa arrest that happened in August, was able to do, right? So basically what ended up happening was that they were able to make, quote-unquote, alleged terrorists your neighbor. It's the person who's the most well-rounded, the most well-integrated, the one you would least suspect. So basically you have to suspect everyone. That's ultimately what the take-home message is, essentially is. And specifically they would make mention of Khurram in terms of his profession as a physician. And the Globe and Mail in an August 27th editorial basically said, "The call of jihad rings far and wide, and the Globe expresses shock that one of the men alleged to be involved accepted the Hippocratic Oath." So, you know, again, it's the same thing of basically passing off judgment before the trials actually even happened. There's a bunch of other examples that we can look at. But the other thing I wanted to bring up in this context is the media's role in perpetuating a certain agenda from the political class or the government. Specifically in the Ottawa Citizen, for example, Vic Toews, public safety minister, basically said, quote, "There are people inside our country who for one reason or another have become radicalized." Again, this is it's a statement of fact. They become radicalized. Again, there's been no trial. None of the charges have been confirmed. Another article in the Toronto Star, entitled "Third Terror Suspect Was Canadian Idol Contestant," a spokesperson for the public safety minister said that the case shows that Canada is not immune from international or homegrown radicalization. So again, just passing off these things as if they're a given. Now, there's some take-home points I think that are relevant from a lot of the media stuff that came out around the Project Samosa arrests. And one is that the media in these cases, I feel, served a useful role, not for practical purposes, but in terms of for the government and the agenda it has, of spreading fear and of shaping public opinion that is very pernicious for trial as well. Imagine a jury trial where people have read all these newspapers with these kinds of articles, and imagine whether a juror will be truly neutral after having read things like this. Not only that, but then the media's effectively ended up also increasing the paranoia in Muslim, South Asian, Arab communities as a result of this. There's also a question of the collusion between media and the security or policing institutions, right? So oftentimes what ends up happening is that as soon as there's some kind of a big sensational arrest like this, oftentimes it's actually interestingly timed with some other, thing happening that's perhaps causing some issues in terms of domestic or foreign policy, and so there's like a distractor. But what's always informative is how journalists get a lot of the information that's quote unquote leaked. Who's actually leaking that? And I think that's quite pertinent because there are, we have seen over the years certain journalists get the scoop on certain exposés or whatnot that end up being done, and they can never reveal their sources. And then the last point I think that's also important is the media as a mouthpiece for government propaganda, which, the last two examples I gave show quite well. So in terms of what to do, I think in the context of the Project Samosa arrests, there were groups that made releases, No One's Legal Vancouver, No One's Legal Montreal, the People's Commission Network, No One's Legal Ottawa, denounced categorically the sensational nature of the arrests and the horrible journalistic reporting that happened at the time. So that's important, but obviously that in and of itself doesn't stem the tide. I think it's important to press journalists and press corporate media specifically for honest and accurate, as well as accountable and responsible journalism, because that clearly is not happening. And one of the demands in general in any of these kinds of situations should be that the people who are charged, the accused, get a fair trial. Because that's ultimately the main issue, right? Is that all the kind of framing of by the media ends up jeopardizing significantly their chance at a fair trial. And the other thing I think that's also important is supporting community-based initiatives that come out of things like this, because I think the Project Somoza arrest had a significant impact on different communities in Montreal, specifically the Pakistani Muslim community. But I feel like a lot of the people from the Pakistani Muslim community sort of started responding and trying to learning their own rights around, you know, visits from CSIS, for example, what to do, what are your rights, and also dispelling the myths, and I think that's important, but not doing that in a defensive way necessarily. So I'm actually running out of time. I'm just going to close off. Maybe in the question and answer period, I wanted to touch on the reasonable accommodations debate, but maybe in the Q&A we can talk on that. In terms of generally organizing resistance to Islamophobia, I just wanted to close off on that. The movement that was there that I didn't get a chance to talk about too much, but around the reasonable accommodations debate. Served as an effective example of local and effective organizing to challenge the role that the media play in propagating Islamophobia by shifting the national discussion in the province. Campaigns that I was hoping to talk about around security certificates and the 1267 list are examples of local campaigns, but with way more significant, far-reaching effects, because the notion of security and anti-terrorism measures are actually challenged directly. Organizing against Islamophobia should compel people to root our struggles in the response to the oppressive realities and systems of domination that are mentioned earlier. And I think attacks on Muslims, Arabs, South Asians, and their communities must be perceived as an attack on everyone. You know, the common quote is, an injury to one is an injury to all. If we keep quiet while another group is victimized, there basically will be no one left to defend us when we are targeted. And that's the importance of grassroots organizing as a tool to develop and maintain cultures of resistance against oppression of all forms, using justice and dignity as guiding principles. If history serves as our guide, it tells us that the social freedoms we enjoy now are because of struggles and movements of the past. And so we must struggle for social our struggle for social justice implies a solidarity both within our communities and outside of our communities, because ultimately, no one is free until we are all free. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Samir. About the media as a mouthpiece for the government, perhaps you've heard about the tragic incident that happened in Alexandria at the end of the year 2010. There's a very old church there called the Church of the Saints. And on the eve of the 1st of January, this is a big celebration for Christians in Egypt, Coptic Christians, an explosion happened and 8 people died. And of course, who was to be blamed? In Egypt, you have the Muslims and you have the Christians. In the media said, of course, it must be the Muslims. And who the Muslims? The Islamists. We were horrified. I mean, we lived on the same soil for almost 1,400 years. And this was something unprecedented. We were very sorry because we knew that we would not come to know who actually produced, who did this act of terrorism. We know that the media in Egypt was controlled by the government, and it was almost impossible to know what the truth is. And here, the way the incident was happened is like Muslims are attacking the Christians, and look at what they are doing. Fortunately, and this didn't take long, now it turns out that it is the government who did this explosion, who didn't mind sacrificing lives, and there were Muslims killed in this incident, because they wanted to foment unrest between Muslims and Christians. And this now is documented. So we have to be very careful about how we read the news about terrorists. Another thing, it's Islamophobia is not only affecting minorities in the West and in Europe. You have a place like India, where 140 million people, Muslims, live. And the same ideology, the same phrasing, those are terrorists, those are the enemies. Although it's they have the same culture, and again, they lived for centuries peacefully, but now there are tensions between the Hindus and the Muslims. Of course, they don't date from September 11, they date from well before, but they have been, I would say, fomented and activated because of what they hear here in the West. So Islamophobia extends to many minority groups, some you wouldn't have expected existed, but in places where Muslims are minority, in Russia also, and in, we mentioned India and other places, it's the same idea that those are the enemies, and we have to fear them. They are the threat among us. Our next speaker now is Dr. Shirley Steinbergs. She's an associate professor and co-founder and director of the Paulo Anita Freire International Project for Critical Pedagogy. The project is dedicated to building an international critical community which works to promote social justice in a variety of cultural contexts. She has written and co-edited many books. The list is too long, so I will just mention the ones that deal specifically with our subject today. Diversity and Multiculturalism, a Reader. She co-edited books including Teaching Against Islamophobia, Media Literacy, and The Miseducation of the West, How Schools and Media Distort Our Understanding of the Islam World. She's a regular contributor to CBC, Radio 1, CTV, the Toronto Globe and Mail, the Montreal Gazette, and the Canadian Press. She's an internationally acclaimed speaker and teacher. The Paulo Freire Democratic Project and the College of Educational Studies, Chapman University, has nominated Shirley Steinberg to receive its annual Social Justice Award. So congratulations to Professor Steinberg.
I talk loud. Thank you. I apologize for my lateness. We can never count on airlines. I was raised as a Jewish girl in the United States and only thought that Israel was the most important place on earth because that's what I was told, and really didn't have a consciousness of other brothers and sisters, other semi-people that were involved in Israel. The first time I thought about it really was in 1968 when Robert Kennedy was killed, and I remember the byline. He was killed by a man called Saran Saran, a man of Jordanian descent. And that was the constant label. Every time you saw the name of the killer, a man of Jordanian descent. And I remember just hearing that over and over again. I mean, I'd seen Lawrence of Arabia. I saw how the British made the Arabian Peninsula much, much more civilized than it had already been. I'd had those visions. And then there was a Time magazine cover, and I remember this because I wrote about it in high school social studies, and it was the plight of the Arab refugee. I didn't know there were Arabic refugees. I didn't know that. No one had told me that in my shul, in my synagogue, in my school. I just knew that there was Israel. And so I started to read about people, and when I did go to the area that's now known as Israel, I went out to Jericho, and I saw camps. And I realized as a very young girl, I didn't understand why people who belonged in a nation and in a land were in camps. And it took me a long time to understand that. But I still felt that desire to defend the concept of a Jewish homeland. That is until September 12, 2001. I was teaching at Brooklyn College, and our classes had been called off because of the towers going down. And the next morning, I started to get phone calls. I taught in Brooklyn. Brooklyn fed into three kinds of students, really. Caribbean, Orthodox Jews, and a lot of women, especially from an area known as Little Pakistan. Ironically, that area doesn't exist anymore. This was Atlantic Avenue. What happened was all of a sudden my Indian or Arabic Muslim students were phoning me and saying, people are throwing rocks at us. We can't leave our building. We can't get to school. So I got a series of these phone calls, and all of a sudden I realized this is serious stuff. I happened to have the number for CNN News, and so I phoned them and got directly to the news line. And I said, I have something for you. I'm a professor at Brooklyn College. I work with a lot of students in the area known as Little Pakistan, also a lot of South Asians. I'm very concerned because my students are being harassed and not allowed to leave their building. They can't leave their area. Many of the halal neighborhood markets have been closed and people are being attacked. And all of a sudden there was all this news, like noise, like all kinds of microphones and people yelling. And the guy said, you better get off the line. As many of them as we can get, I'm happy. This isn't news. And he hung up. And that was CNN. That moment changed my life, not the Twin Towers. That moment changed my life. And I realized a very important point that my own theories had always told me, is that oppressed people are kept being oppressed because the dominant culture, it is in their best interest to see oppressed people attack one another. So as long as we have Jews against Arabs, Pakistani against Indian, Dominicans against Puerto Ricans, African Americans against Jamaicans, we will always have a way in which white dominant culture stays in power. Now that's a very important knowledge to know about one who's oppressed. The unfortunate thing for me to stand here and talk to the group of people I see is that I see many people wearing hijab, many men who are obviously identifiably either South Asian or Muslim. I see a group of my own Asian students. I know some of the Jewish students. And it's like preaching to the converted. We know what oppression is. And then I see white women. Unfortunately, this conference is so important, but it's addressing the people who already know, most of them, what oppression is like. And so all I can do is say, it's important to name it, it's important to call it out, it's important to stand up for it. One of the ways we do that is teaching our students to become literate, and our families, our children, our spouses, our parents, about watching the news and understanding many times what is being said is not what's important. It's what's not being said. In 2008, during the American election, that's the one that really was an election as opposed to the other two that were selection, 23 million copies of a DVD were released. They were placed in the top newspapers in the United States and Canada, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Herald Examiner, the Chicago Tribune. And any of you who are in higher education probably know, if you're ever looking for jobs, the Chronicle of Higher Education. That's how I first got a copy of this movie. Someone had backed the production of 23 million copies of this movie. I'm going to show you the trailer.
Obsession, the documentary movie about Islam's war against the West.
You can take over USA! You can take over USA! We trust in Allah!
It gives a scary look inside the extremist world.
I'm fucking the agent!
Oh, it's chilling. It is chilling. It is shocking beyond belief. This needs to be seen by everybody in America, in Europe.
Do you think Americans grasp the full threat of radical Islam?
I close in America!
Well, you can definitely get an incredible education by watching this film, Obsession.
This film, Obsession, is without exaggeration one of the most important films of our time.
You must see it.
That was handed out at the Democratic National Convention as well. Just quickly, what were the images you saw? Just yell them out.
Twin towers.
Lots of explosions. Children with guns. Did you see how see the machine gun? What were some of the images we saw? What were some of the moving images you saw?
There weren't any women.
Oh, of course not. Did you see the salute? What was the salute? Like Nazis. A little bit of a button pusher. What about the people who were speaking? Who are those people?
White.
What else?
Fox News, right?
But also CNN. MSNBC. They were voices of authority. What was some of the, can you remember some of the words? If we had more time, I'd play it one more time, but what were the words used? What were we told?
Radical.
Threat. What did you say?
Threat.
Islam.
Most important.
Most important. What did they call this film?
Educational.
And what was it? What kind of film was it?
Documentary.
A documentary. I don't know a lot of radical Catholics. I don't know a lot of radical Lutherans. I don't know a lot of radical United Church people. They go to church. They believe in their religion. But somehow, Islamophobia has adopted the word radical, which tends to imply leftist, which is sort of interesting, because it's a knee-jerk word. It's a knee-jerk word. And these ideas of Islamicists, all these words that start to maintain this need to fear. Another show that's very interesting was Sleeper Cell, a very interesting movie with a very hot star, who the whole trailer, if you ever bring it up online, will tell you that they're everywhere. They're next door. They can be your child's best friend. The person at the grocery store. In fact, in Sleeper Cell, the one Muslim infiltrator infiltrates at a synagogue. We're never safe. I was in Florida, that's why I was late, and listening, I was told that we're under the orange threat code. Never are we let alone to believe there is not a threat. A threat. A threat. A threat. This is language that the media constantly uses. Go back to your childhood watching Disney's Aladdin, the very first song. Come to my land, my faraway land, a land where caravans roam. They'll cut off your ear in spite of your face, but hey, it's barbaric, but it's home. The notion that Islamic and Arabic people, which aren't always the same, by the way, are barbaric. The language of barbarism, the language of the sword swishing, many-wived Muslim man who always beats his wife or wives. The notion of Islamic women as women without a choice. They are forced to cover their heads. They are forced to be submissive to their husbands. The idea that there's an entire culture of people that is indeed brainwashed becomes a real question that we need to address in media. Quebec, ironically, considering the Turner hearings, is the only province that asked that we teach media literacy in our classroom. I would say maybe it's the wrong media literacy. I would say that along with media literacy, we need, as people involved in social justice, to engage marginalized people to say, our battle is your battle. Many of us forget that Jews and Arabs are brothers and sisters. We come from the same father, according to our holy books. We are as close as it gets genetically. And yet the dominant culture and the culture of corporatism, which you spoke about, is engaged in trying to constantly pit us together. I'm very uncomfortable with what I watch. I was just in the airport running by, and I saw that there's uprisings in Syria. Now we've had Egypt, we've had Libya, we've had Tunisia, and now Syria. I'm a little uncomfortable because I'm asking the question which my culture, my scholarly theory asks, in whose best interest does this serve? Who are the positions of power? And as Marx would have asked, what are the economic positions of power? And when I start to see the Middle East implode, I'm not as uncomfortable with radical Islam as I am about corporate interests within and outside a country, that their best interest is to see Middle Eastern, Arabic, Muslim countries implode. So I want to ask questions. And as a scholar, as someone in education, I ask you to make sure that you are able to question people. What exactly do you mean when you say that? Why is it that a woman cannot cover her face in classroom, but a Hasidic Jew with a great big black beard and curls and a big hat can? If I stand my Chinese, Japanese, and Korean students up for 2 seconds and then ask them to go away, pretty well everyone in the room is not going to be able to tell them apart. But for some reason, they're not a threat. But a woman in a religious garb is all of a sudden a threat. I believe that we need to speak up and we need to have allies, critical friends and allies that can reach across all these partitions and horrendous walls that have been created by economic and power sources that whose best interest is oil, arms, and domination, and start to create a dialogue, a grassroots dialogue, which can start in a university. So I ask and pray that we can all, each of us, consider the concept of peace and understand that it is not in power and domination's best interest for us to seek peace. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shirley Steinberg. I think the most important element of this talk, the one that will stay with me, is the importance of being critical. How do you listen to the media? How do you read the media? And again, I want to share with you my experience in Egypt when I went this last time. There was a referendum about the constitution. The constitution has been rewritten, and Egyptians were asked to say whether they approved or disapproved. So it was a yes or no, and by all accounts, it was an honest voting. But people were very puzzled. Of course, the referendum, there were a lot of articles that have been changed, and it was difficult to understand the full implication of those articles. So the invariably, the discussion started. So did you vote yes or no? And I heard this comment. One woman said, it was very hard to know how to vote because we were never taught to think for ourselves. And if we come out of this panel knowing just the importance of thinking for yourself, of being critical, that would be a great accomplishment. So I thank all our panelists, and now we open the floor for questions.